Welcome to CraftLit, the podcast for crafters who like books. My name is Heather Wardover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. This week, episode 21. Irony, anyone? Well, hello, everyone. I am very excited today because today I have not one, not two, but three short texts for you. And as you can probably tell from the title of this week's episode, these are all deeply ironic pieces. Now, if any of you are parents and parents of teenagers, first, let me say I taught high school for 10 years in New York. I feel your pain. But the second thing is one of the problems that I had noticed in teaching was that kids today just don't get irony. And the kids who do are much, much better off on all of those blasted tests that they have to take these days. Now, irony, there have been lots of articles that we are living in an age of where people just don't understand irony anymore. And I think it is, well, it's problematic for a number of reasons, and you'll see why in today's stories. These are the kinds of stories that when I was in seventh, eighth grade, the kids went absolutely nuts for because they have twists at the end, unexpected twists at the end. They come out of left field right at the end of the story, and it leaves you going, hey, wait a minute. And it gives kids a whole lot to talk about. So if you are the parent of, I'd say these stories could probably be good for anyone from, you know, a pretty with it 12-year-old all the way up to senior year of high school. There's one story that they may already have read because it's used in American lit anthologies quite often, but I'll explain that when I get there. You might want to have them listen to these stories and then talk to you about it and just kind of get a beat on whether your kid can understand irony or not. So many things in college and, gosh, just in life will be easier if they have a rich sense of irony. The two pieces that start today are simply deeply ironic and beautifully written. The last piece is a satiric piece from Mark Twain that is both a satire and ironic. And that's the one that I'll have to explain more when we get there. The first piece, some of you may already know, is called The Lady or the Tiger. This piece was written by a man named Frank R. Stockton. And while he was fairly popular in his own day, really the only thing we know him for these days is this one story. And you'll see why it's lasted so long. He was born in Philadelphia. He was the son of a rather well-known Methodist minister. And his father tried to get him not to write. So he worked as a wood engraver until his father died, and then he started writing. He did, like I said, very well for himself as a writer. I don't know how he did as a wood engraver, but clearly he should have been writing the whole time. He wrote a lot of stories for children, like kind of like fairy tale stories, and those were bestsellers. You know, he was a popular guy. Mark Twain actually talks about going to his funeral in Mark Twain's autobiography. So he was obviously pretty darn well known. But that doesn't mean that we read anything he wrote anymore, which is a shame. So if you get a chance, look for some stuff by Frank R. Stockton, because The Lady or the Tiger is a wonderful and deeply ironic story. You have to listen closely to hear the few hints that he lays out for you for what will happen at the end, which is another good reason why it's great to have kids listen to the story. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I should tell you about the story. Do remember that this was written in the late 1800s, so his the way he talks about other peoples, even in the most general terms, are it's probably using language that simply wouldn't be used now. But it certainly adds flavor to his story, and it does give it a special sense of time and place. So, without any further ado, I give you Frank R. Stockton's The Lady or the Tiger.
The Lady or the Tiger by Frank R. Stockton. In the very olden time, there lived a semi-barbaric king, whose ideas, though somewhat polished and sharpened by the progressiveness of distant Latin neighbors, were still large, florid, and untrammeled, as became the half of him which was barbaric. He was a man of exuberant fancy, and withal, of an authority so irresistible that, at his will, he turned his varied fancies into facts. He was greatly given to self-communing, and when he and himself agreed upon anything, the thing was done. When every member of his domestic and political systems moved smoothly in its appointed course, his nature was bland and genial. But whenever there was a little hitch and some of his orbs got out of their orbits, he was blander and more genial still, for nothing pleased him so much as to make the crooked straight and crush down uneven places. Among the borrowed notions by which his barbarism had become semified was that of the public arena, in which, by exhibitions of manly and beastly valor, the minds of his subjects were refined and cultured. But even here the exuberant and barbaric fancy asserted itself. The arena of the king was built, not to give the people an opportunity of hearing the rhapsodies of dying gladiators, nor to enable them to view the inevitable conclusion of a conflict between religious opinions and hungry jaws, but for purposes far better adapted to widen and develop the mental energies of the people. This vast amphitheatre, with its encircling galleries, its mysterious vaults, and its unseen passages, was an agent of poetic justice, in which crime was punished, or virtue rewarded, by the decrees of an impartial and incorruptible chance. When a subject was accused of a crime of sufficient importance to interest the king, public notice was given that on an appointed day the fate of the accused person would be decided in the king's arena, a structure which well deserved its name, for, although its form and plan were borrowed from afar, its purpose emanated solely from the brain of this man, who, every barleycorn a king, knew no tradition to which he owed more allegiance than pleased his fancy, and who engrafted on every adopted form of human thought and action the rich growth of his barbaric idealism. When all the people had assembled in the galleries, and the king, surrounded by his court, sat high up on his throne of royal state on one side of the arena, he gave a signal, a door beneath him opened, and the accused subject stepped out into the amphitheatre. Directly opposite him, on the other side of the enclosed space, were two doors, exactly alike and side by side. It was the duty and the privilege of the person on trial to walk directly to these doors and open one of them. He could open either door he pleased. He was subject to no guidance or influence but that of the aforementioned impartial and incorruptible chance. If he opened the one, there came out of it a hungry tiger, the fiercest and most cruel that could be procured, which immediately sprang upon him and tore him to pieces as a punishment for his guilt. The moment that the case of the criminal was thus decided, doleful iron bells were clanged, great wails went up from the hired mourners posted on the outer rim of the arena, and the vast audience, with bowed heads and downcast hearts, wended slowly their homeward way, mourning greatly that one so young and fair, or so old and respected, should have merited so dire a fate. But if the accused person opened the other door, there came forth from it a lady, the most suitable to his years and station, that his majesty could select among his fair subjects, and to this lady he was immediately married as a reward for his innocence. It mattered not that he might already possess a wife and family, or that his affections might be engaged upon an object of his own selection. The king allowed no such subordinate arrangements to interfere with his great scheme of retribution and reward. The exercises, as in the other instance, took place immediately, and in the arena. Another door opened beneath the king, and a priest, followed by a band of choristers and dancing maidens blowing joyous airs on golden horns and treading an epithalamic measure, advanced to where the pair stood, side by side, and the wedding was promptly and cheerily solemnized. Then the gay brass bells rang forth their merry peals, the people shouted glad hurrahs, and the innocent man, preceded by children strewing flowers on his path, led his bride to his home. This was the king's semi-barbaric method of administering justice. Its perfect fairness is obvious. The criminal could not know out of which door would come the lady. He opened either he pleased, without having the slightest idea whether, in the next instant, he was to be devoured or married. On some occasions the tiger came out of one door, and on some out of the other. The decisions of the tribunal were not only fair, they were positively determinate. The accused person was instantly punished if he found himself guilty, and, if innocent, he was rewarded on the spot, whether he liked it or not. There was no escape from the judgments of the king's arena. The institution was a very popular one. When the people gathered together on one of the great trial days, they never knew whether they were to witness a bloody slaughter or a hilarious wedding. This element of uncertainty lent an interest to the occasion, which it could not otherwise have attained. Thus, the masses were entertained and pleased, and the thinking part of the community could bring no charge of unfairness against this plan, for did not the accused person have the whole matter in his own hands? This semi-barbaric king had a daughter as blooming as his most florid fancies, and with a soul as fervent and imperious as his own. As is usual in such cases, she was the apple of his eye, and was loved by him above all humanity. Among his courtiers was a young man of that fineness of blood and lowness of station common to the conventional heroes of romance who love royal maidens. This royal maiden was well satisfied with her lover, for he was handsome and brave, to a degree unsurpassed in all this kingdom, and she loved him with an ardor that had enough of barbarism in it to make it exceedingly warm and strong. This love affair moved on happily for many months, until one day the king happened to discover its existence. He did not hesitate nor waver in regard to his duty in the premises. The youth was immediately cast into prison, and a day was appointed for his trial in the king's arena. This, of course, was an especially important occasion, and His Majesty, as well as all the people, was greatly interested in the workings and development of this trial. Never before had such a case occurred. Never before had a subject dared to love the daughter of the king. In after years such things became commonplace enough, but then they were in no slight degree novel and startling. The tiger cages of the kingdom were searched for the most savage and relentless beasts, from which the fiercest monster might be selected for the arena. And the ranks of maiden youth and beauty throughout the land were carefully surveyed by competent judges, in order that the young man might have a fitting bride in case fate did not determine for him a different destiny. Of course, everybody knew that the deed with which the accused was charged had been done. He had loved the princess, and neither he, she, nor anyone else thought of denying the fact. But the king would not think of allowing any fact of this kind to interfere with the workings of the tribunal, in which he took such great delight and satisfaction. No matter how the affair turned out, the youth would be disposed of, and the king would take an aesthetic pleasure in watching the course of events, which would determine whether or not the young man had done wrong in allowing himself to love the princess. The appointed day arrived. From far and near the people gathered, and thronged the great galleries of the arena, and crowds, unable to gain admittance, massed themselves against its outside walls. The king and his court were in their places, opposite the twin doors, those fateful portals, so terrible in their similarity. All was ready. The signal was given. A door beneath the royal party opened, and the lover of the princess walked into the arena. Tall, beautiful, fair, his appearance was greeted with a low hum of admiration and anxiety. Half the audience had not known so grand a youth had lived among them. No wonder the princess loved him. What a terrible thing for him to be there! As the youth advanced into the arena, he turned, as the custom was, to bow to the king. But he did not think at all of that royal personage. His eyes were fixed upon the princess, who sat to the right of her father. Had it not been for the moiety of barbarism in her nature, it is probable that lady would not have been there. But her intense and fervid soul would not allow her to be absent on an occasion in which she was so terribly interested. From the moment that the decree had gone forth that her lover should decide his fate in the king's arena, she had thought of nothing, night or day, but this great event and the various subjects connected with it. Possessed of more power, influence, and force of character than anyone who had ever before been interested in such a case, She had done what no other person had done. She had possessed herself of the secret of the doors. She knew in which of the two rooms that lay beneath those doors stood the cage of the tiger, with its open front, and in which waited the lady. Through these thick doors, heavily curtained with skins on the inside, it was impossible that any noise or suggestion should come from within to the person who should approach to raise the latch of one of them. But gold, and the power of a woman's will, had brought the secret to the princess. And not only did she know in which room stood the lady ready to emerge, all blushing and radiant, should her door be opened, but she knew who the lady was. It was one of the fairest and loveliest of the damsels of the court who had been selected as the reward of the accused youth, should he be proved innocent of the crime of aspiring to one so far above him. And the princess hated her. Often had she seen, or imagined that she had seen, this fair creature throwing glances of admiration upon the person of her lover. And sometimes she thought these glances were perceived, and even returned. Now and then she had seen them talking together. It was but for a moment or two, but much can be said in a brief space. It may have been on most unimportant topics, but how could she know that? The girl was lovely, but she had dared to raise her eyes to the loved one of the princess, and with all the intensity of the savage blood transmitted to her through long lines of holy barbaric ancestors, she hated the woman who blushed and trembled behind that silent door. When her lover turned and looked at her, and his eye met hers as she sat there, paler and whiter than anyone in the vast ocean of anxious faces about her, he saw, by that power of quick perception which is given to those whose souls are one, that she knew behind which door crouched the tiger, and behind which stood the lady. He had expected her to know it. He understood her nature, and his soul was assured that she would never rest until she had made plain to herself this thing, hidden to all other lookers-on, even to the king. The only hope for the youth in which there was any element of certainty was based upon the success of the princess in discovering this mystery, and the moment he looked upon her, he saw she had succeeded, as in his soul he knew she would succeed. Then it was that his quick and anxious glance asked the question, "Which?" It was as plain to her as if he had shouted it from where he stood. There was not an instant to be lost. The question was asked in a flash. It must be answered in another. Her right arm lay on the cushioned parapet before her. She raised her hand and made a slight, quick movement toward the right. No one but her lover saw her. Every eye but his was fixed on the man in the arena. He turned, and with a firm and rapid step, he walked across the empty space. Every heart stopped beating. Every breath was held. Every eye was fixed immovably upon that man. Without the slightest hesitation, he went to the door on the right and opened it. Now, the point of the story is this. Did the tiger come out of that door, or did the lady? The more we reflect upon this question, the harder it is to answer. It involves a study of the human heart which leads us through devious mazes of passion, out of which it is difficult to find our way. Think of it, fair reader. Not as if the decision of the question depended upon yourself, but upon that hot-blooded, semi-barbaric princess, her soul at a white heat beneath the combined fires of despair and jealousy. She had lost him, but who should have him? Often, in her waking hours and in her dreams, had she started in wild horror and covered her face with her hands as she thought of her lover opening the door on the other side of which waited the cruel fangs of the tiger. But how much oftener had she seen him at the other door? How in her grievous reveries had she gnashed her teeth and torn her hair when she saw his start of rapturous delight as he opened the door of the lady? How her soul had burned in agony when she had seen him rush to meet that woman with her flushing cheek and sparkling eye of triumph. When she had seen him lead her forth, his whole frame kindled with the joy of recovered life. When she had heard the glad shouts from the multitude, and the wild ringing of the happy bells, when she had seen the priest, with his joyous followers, advance to the couple, and make them man and wife before her very eyes, and when she had seen them walk away together upon their path of flowers, followed by the tremendous shouts of the hilarious multitude, in which her one despairing shriek was lost and drowned. Would it not be better for him to die at once, and go to wait for her in the blessed regions of semi-barbaric futurity? And yet, that awful tiger, those shrieks, that blood! Her decision had been indicated in an instant, but it had been made after days and nights of anguished deliberation. She had known she would be asked. She had decided what she would answer, and without the slightest hesitation she had moved her hand to the right. The question of her decision is not to be lightly considered, and it is not for me to presume to set myself up as the one person able to answer it. And so I leave it with all of you. Which came out of the opened door? The lady or the tiger?
Wasn't that wonderful? Doesn't it just make you want to scream? I know, it's mean. It's mean to make you listen to a story on a podcast when we can't sit down over a cup of coffee and talk about what we think the princess did. But it's a great story. Lots and lots of good details leading up to that wonderful ending. And I thought the reader did a pretty nice job. Hang on. We're having ceiling fan issues. I guess I should turn it off. Sorry about that. I don't know if you could hear the dinging, but I sure could, and it was driving me nuts. So that was Frank Stockton's The Lady and the Tiger. Now, the next one, the next piece that I'm going to play for you is actually one that I recorded for LibriVox, so I apologize. You're going to get a lot of me today. But this next piece is by a writer named Kate Chopin, and her last name is spelled Chopin, but I heard all the way through college and grad school that it was pronounced Chopin, you know, being an American and not being able to pronounce a blessed thing correctly in America. I don't actually know what the correct pronunciation of her name is. I'm just using the one that I'm most used to because I'm going to mess up and call her that anyway. But she was a woman who wrote. She lived from 1850 to 1904, and she was a tough, tough cookie. One of the quotations that she's famous for is, "Perhaps it is better to wake up after all, even if we suffer, than to remain a dupe to illusions all one's life." So you can tell that she's tough. And somebody on a webpage put down that she had written on a sentimental greeting card, "Very pretty, but what's the point?" Yeah, she's a tough cookie. Kate Chopin is famous for having written The Awakening, which she did get into some trouble for, but it wasn't banned the way some people kind of... I don't know, there's kind of a urban legend that her books were getting banned right, left, and center, and I don't think that is true. What is true is that The Story of an Hour, the piece I'm about to play for you today, which is very brief, it's only 2 pages, because it's only the story of an hour, not 10 days, it is kind of loosely based on what happened to her mother. Not entirely, but kinda. So you may want to look old Kate up on the web and read some history about her, because she is a fascinating woman. Obviously, anyone back in the day who could make a living writing was someone who was very strong and up for a challenge. But Story of an Hour is a text that is often used on high school tests because it is short and because it has a very, very easy to misunderstand, ironic twist at the end. And I'm not kidding you, it's the end. It's like the last sentence where you get it. So listen closely for it. We will talk about that ironic twist when we get to the end, because I want to make sure you understood it. And honestly, not because you couldn't understand it, but because I'm not sure I'm speaking loud enough on the LibriVox recording. It's the first thing I ever recorded on this particular setup, and I think the levels might be kind of low. And as I said, I can't hear any playback, so I'm not going to be able to tell what my levels are before I send this out. So, without any further yammering, The Story of an Hour by Kate Chopin. The Story of an Hour by Kate Chopin. Knowing that Mrs. Mallard was afflicted with a heart trouble,
Great care was taken to break to her as gently as possible the news of her husband's death. It was her sister Josephine who told her, in broken sentences, veiled hints that revealed in half-concealing. Her husband's friend Richards was there too, near her. It was he who had been in the newspaper office when intelligence of the railroad disaster was received, with Brently Mallard's name leading the list of killed. He had only taken the time to assure himself of its truth by a second telegram, and had hastened to forestall any less careful, less tender friend in bearing the sad message. She did not hear the story as many women have heard the same, with a paralyzed inability to accept its significance. She wept at once, with sudden, wild abandonment, in her sister's arms. When the storm of grief had spent itself, she went away to her room alone. She would have no one follow her. There stood, facing the open window, a comfortable, roomy armchair. Into this she sank, pressed down by a physical exhaustion that haunted her body and seemed to reach into her soul. She could see in the open square before her the tops of trees that were all aquiver with the new spring life. The delicious breath of rain was in the air. In the street below, a peddler was crying his wares. The notes of a distant song which someone was singing reached her faintly, and countless sparrows were twittling in the eaves. There were patches of blue sky showing here and there through the clouds that had met and piled one above the other in the west facing her window. She sat with her head thrown back upon the cushion of the chair, quite motionless, except when a sob came up into her throat and shook her, as a child who has cried itself to sleep continues to sob in its dreams. She was young, with a fair, calm face whose lines bespoke repression and even a certain strength. But now there was a dull stare in her eyes, whose gaze was fixed away off yonder on one of those patches of blue sky. It was not a glance of reflection, but rather it indicated a suspension of intelligent thought. There was something coming to her, and she was waiting for it, fearfully. What was it? She did not know. It was too subtle and elusive to name, but she felt it, creeping out of the sky, reaching toward her through the sounds, the scents, the color that filled the air. Now her bosom rose and fell tumultuously. She was beginning to recognize this thing that was approaching to possess her, and she was striving to beat it back with her will, as powerless as her two white slender hands would have been. When she abandoned herself, a little whispered word escaped her slightly parted lips. She said it over and over under her breath. Free, free, free. The vacant stare and the look of terror that had followed it went from her eyes. They stayed keen and bright. Her pulses beat fast, and the coursing blood warmed and relaxed every inch of her body. She did not stop to ask if it were or were not a monstrous joy that held her. A clear and exalted perception enabled her to dismiss the suggestion as trivial. She knew that she would weep again when she saw the kind, tender hands folded in death, the face that had never looked, save with love, upon her, fixed and gray and dead. But she saw beyond that bitter moment a long procession of years to come that would belong to her absolutely, and she opened and spread her arms out to them in welcome. There would be no one to live for during those coming years. She would live for herself. There would be no powerful will bending hers in that blind persistence with which men and women believe they have a right to impose a private will upon a fellow creature. A kind intention or a cruel intention made the act seem no less a crime, as she looked upon it in that brief moment of illumination. And yet, she had loved him, sometimes. Often she had not. What did it matter? What could love, the unsolved mystery, count for in the face of this possession of self-assertion, which she suddenly recognized as the strongest impulse of her being? Free, body and soul free, she kept whispering. Josephine was kneeling before the closed door with her lips to the keyhole, imploring for admission. Louise, open the door, I beg, open the door. You will make yourself ill. What are you doing, Louise? For heaven's sake, open the door. Go away. I am not making myself ill. No. She was drinking in a very elixir of life through that open window. Her fancy was running riot all along those days ahead of her. Spring days and summer days and all sorts of days that would be her own. She breathed a quick prayer that life might be long. It was only yesterday she had thought with a shudder that life might be long. She arose at length and opened the door to her sister's importunities. There was a feverish triumph in her eyes, and she carried herself unwittingly like a goddess of victory. She clasped her sister's waist, and together they descended the stairs. Richard stood waiting for them at the bottom. Someone was opening the front door with a latch key. It was Brently Mallard who entered, a little travel-stained, composedly carrying his gripsack and umbrella. He had been far from the scene of the accident, and did not even know there had been one. He stood amazed at Josephine's piercing cry, at Richard's quick motion to scream him from the view of his wife. When the doctors came, they said she had died of heart disease, of the joy that kills.
So, poor Mrs. Mallard, huh? So I hope it was clear. I hope the audio was loud enough. I hope you could hear that when she thought her husband was dead, to her it was, although a little sad and melancholy because he had been a kind man, to her his death meant freedom. And when he walked in the door and she realized that it was over and she would no longer be free, she dropped dead. It is not the ending people generally expect from a story, especially a story from that era, the late 1800s. So, irony, deep and abiding irony. The last piece for you today is by Mark Twain. And I don't know if you're familiar with Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, but this is kind of like that, although much, much shorter. For those of you who don't know, Swift wrote, and certainly if you're interested in it, I will do a little bit more research on it and play it for you. I think it would probably take up an entire show. Swift wrote an essay when there was a really hideous famine going on in Ireland. And of course, all famine is political. It's not just, you know, it doesn't rain. There are lots and lots of things that have to happen coincide to create a real famine. So people were dying and children were dying. And Jonathan Swift was merely making clear some of the nasty things he was hearing from other people. And one of the criticisms he was hearing was that people had too many children. And if they didn't have so many children, they would have plenty of food. And so his suggestion was that you should eat the children. Now, of course, Jonathan Swift did not believe this, but in order to shock people into realizing what they're actually suggesting, he had to say something fairly brutal, and he did, and he made his point. And people are still, to this day, reading Jonathan Swift's piece, A Modest Proposal, because it is kind of horrifyingly funny because he's a very good writer. This is the guy who wrote Gulliver's Travels. Ooh, that's another book. I wonder if anybody's read. Well, I'll look it up on LibriVox. But he's funny, he's brutal, and he makes his point rather well. Mark Twain follows in that same vein. And it's one of the reasons why he's so easily misunderstood, is that these days, I think pretty much the only satire that's out there on a regular basis is The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. I'm hard-pressed to think of, I guess The Simpsons. The Simpsons do some really good social satire, and that might be it. It's really hard to find good satire. So, Twain. Twain was kind of upset with the way the U.S. was dealing with the Philippines. This is back in the late 1800s. We were messing around with the Philippines. And that continued for some time, as you may know. He dictated this piece in 1904. His wife wouldn't let him publish it. She was his main editor, and she was the arbiter of taste for him. And he deferred to her. He knew that he could push the envelope just a little too much, and she knew where to pull it back. Well, she wouldn't let him publish this, so they made an agreement. And he put it in his will that this was to be published after his death. He said, when he made the direction to have it published after his death, he said, "I have told the truth in that, and only dead men can tell the truth in this world." So the piece that I'm about to read to you is timely, and it is, it's kind of disturbing, as all good satire is, and it is called The War Prayer, by Mark Twain. It was a time of great exulting and excitement. The country was up in arms. The war was on. In every breast burned the holy fire of patriotism. The drums were beating, the bands playing, the toy pistols popping, the bunched firecrackers hissing and sputtering. On every hand and far down the receding and faded spread of roofs and balconies, a fluttering wilderness of flags flashed in the sun. Daily, the young volunteers marched down the wide avenue, gay and fine in their new uniforms, the proud fathers and mothers and sisters and sweethearts cheering them with voices choked with happy emotion as they swung by. Nightly, the packed mass meetings listened, panting, to patriot oratory which stirred the deepest depths of their hearts, and which they interrupted at briefest intervals with cyclones of applause, the tears running down their cheeks the while. In the churches, the pastors preached devotion to flag and country, and invoked the God of battles, beseeching his aid in our good cause in outpourings of fervid eloquence which moved every listener. It was indeed a glad and gracious time, and the half dozen rash spirits that ventured to disprove of the war and cast doubt upon its righteousness straightway got such a stern and angry warning that for their personal safety's sake they quickly shrank out of sight and offended no one more in that way. Sunday morning came. Next day the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled. The volunteers were there, their young faces alight with martial dreams, visions of the stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing sabers, the flight of the foe, the tumult, the enveloping smoke, the fierce pursuit, the surrender. Then, home from the war, bronzed heroes, welcomed, adored, submerged in golden seas of glory. With the volunteers sat their dear ones, proud, happy, and envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor there to win for the flag or, failing, die in the noblest of noble deaths. The service proceeded. A war chapter from the Old Testament was read. The first prayer was said. It was followed by an organ burst that shook the building, and with one impulse the house rose, with glowing eyes and beating hearts, and poured out that tremendous invocation, "God, the all-terrible, thou who ordainest thunder thy clarion and lightning thy sword." Then came the long prayer. None could remember the like of it for passionate pleading and moving and beautiful language. The burden of its supplication was that an ever-merciful and benignant Father of us all would watch over our young noble soldiers and aid, comfort, and encourage them in their patriotic work. Bless them, shield them in the day of battle and the hour of peril, bear them in his mighty hand, make them strong and confident, invincible in the bloody onset, Help them to crush the foe. Grant to them and their flag and country imperishable honor and glory. An aged stranger entered and moved with slow and noiseless step up the main aisle, his eyes fixed upon the minister, his long body clothed in a robe that reached to his feet, his head bare, his white hair descending in a frothy cataract to his shoulders, his seamy face unnaturally pale, pale even to a ghastliness. With all eyes following and wondering, he made his silent way. Without pausing, he ascended to the preacher's side and stood there waiting. With shut lids, the preacher, unconscious of his presence, continued his moving prayer, and at last finished it with the words uttered in fervent appeal, "Bless our arms, grant us victory, O Lord our God, Father and protector of our land and flag." The stranger touched his arm, motioned him to step aside, which the startled minister did, and took his place. During some moments he surveyed the spellbound audience with solemn eyes, in which burned an uncanny light, and then, in a deep voice, he said, "I come from the throne, bearing a message from Almighty God." The words smote the house with a shock. If the stranger perceived it, he gave no attention. "He has heard the prayer of his servant, your shepherd, and will grant it, if such be your desire, after I, his messenger, shall have explained to you its import, that is to say, its full import. For it is like unto many of the prayers of men, in that it asks for more than he who utters it is aware of, except that he pause and think. God's servant and yours has prayed his prayer. He has paused and taken thought. Is it one prayer? No, it is two, one uttered, the other not. Both have reached the ear of him who heareth all supplications, and spoken and unspoken. Ponder this, keep it in mind. If you would beseech a blessing upon yourself, beware, lest without intent you invoke a curse upon a neighbor at the same time. If you pray for the blessing of rain upon your crop which needs it, by that act you are possibly praying for a curse upon some neighbor's crop which may not need rain and can be injured by it. You have heard your servant's prayer, the uttered part of it. I am commissioned of God to put into words the other part of it, that part which the pastor, and also you in your hearts, fervently prayed silently. And ignorantly? And unthinkingly? God grant that it was so. You heard these words, "Grant us victory, O Lord our God." That is sufficient. The whole of the uttered prayer is compact into those pregnant words. Elaborations were not necessary. When you have prayed for victory, you have prayed for many unmentioned results which follow victory, must follow victory, cannot help but follow it. Upon the listening spirit of God the Father fell also the unspoken part of the prayer. He commandeth me to put it into words. Listen. O Lord our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth to battle. Be thou near them. With them in spirit we also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with hurricanes of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless with their little children, to wander, unfriended, the wastes of their desolated land in rags and hunger and thirst, sports of sun, flames of summer, and icy winds of winter, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave, and denied it. For our sakes, who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet, we ask it in the spirit of love, of Him who is the source of love, and who is the ever-faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore beset and seek His aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen. Ye have prayed it. If ye still desire it, speak. The messenger of the Most High awaits. It was believed afterward that the man was a lunatic, because there was simply no sense in what he said. And that is the end of Mark Twain's War Prayer. Well, I apologize for the difficulty I had reading that. Like I said, I can't edit it today. I don't know what's going on. Maybe I'm just running out of memory. But I do apologize for that. It was kind of a clumsy reading, but I am running out of time. I also hope I didn't offend anyone by playing it. It is, I think, a provocative piece that reminds us of something that we seem to find, I think most of us find time to think about one another, kind of on the personal scale, the interpersonal scale. But it is a curiosity to me about, I guess, just how propaganda works. You know, for better or for worse, we all hear a lot of it. And it's just nice every once in a while to have somebody remind you that there's another side, not good or bad. There was no judgment in his text, which I also thought was interesting. You know, he never starts saying, we're the good guys. It's our prayer. However, that prayer does include the flip side to it. So this week was irony. Next week won't be. Next week will be something different. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, episode 21, a short story episode. Next week, I think I'm going to save The Legend of Sleepy Hollow for Halloween. But there are some other pieces that I'm looking forward to doing, and I will keep you in suspense. But I hope you enjoyed today's irony, and I hope you come back next week. Thank you. As always, I'd like to thank our reader. This week it's Alice, who read The Lady or the Tiger, and then, well, there was me doing kind of a clumsy job. As always, Josh Christian is the one who did Chasing Hero, our theme music. You can find a blog for this podcast at craftlit.blogspot.com or craftlit.libsyn.com. That's craftlit, C-R-A-F-T-L-I-T, all one word, and Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. And of course, you can subscribe at iTunes. And do remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.